Hello, everyone. Tom here. Before we get into another excellent episode of Last Orders, I just want to let you all know about Spike's 25th anniversary. Yes, we're celebrating our 25th birthday at the moment. And to celebrate, to mark this milestone, we're doing another donation drive to make sure that we're around for at least another 25 years fighting for freedom and democracy. We've also got a special offer on at the moment. So anyone who donates £25 or more to our anniversary donation drive can get a year's membership to Spike Supporters. That's our online donor community where you can come to exclusive events, read the Spike website completely free of ads, and much more. That's half what you usually pay. So if you'd like to benefit from this offer, go to spiked-online.com/donate and make your £25 donation. If you can't afford that, anything you can give is hugely appreciated. Also, if you're already a Spike supporter and you want to benefit from this offer, make your £25 donation and we'll extend your membership by a year. Once again, that's spiked-online.com/donate.
Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by my co-host, Chris Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
Very well, thank you, Tom. And hello, listeners. Hope you're doing fine.
Hello, listeners, and a big hello to Freddie Attenborough from the Free Speech Union, who's joining us here today. How are you doing, Freddie?
I'm good, Tom. Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Not at all. It's great to have you here, not least because we want to talk about freedom of speech.
Yes.
Labour's war on freedom of speech. It's been hard to keep up. But the one, I suppose, new development which we haven't touched upon on this podcast, is this attempt, this commission, this investigation into should the rules around effectively kind of Islamophobia be toughened up. We've heard Angela Rayner announce that Dominic Grieve is going to lead this effort. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about what's going on there and what people should worry about, what could be in store for us?
Yeah, sure. So this has been bubbling away for quite a while, really, under the Labour government. I mean, you could argue it's been bubbling away under the previous Conservative government too. And so I think the risk that we're talking about here, so this new Islamophobia Council with Dominic Grieve as the chair, it's been tasked with looking at what the government press release describes as, quote, anti-Muslim hatred / Islamophobia. And that's a curious phrase because they're not at all the same thing. So anti-Muslim hatred is already covered by sort of hate speech legislation and incitement legislation. But when we talk about Islamophobia, the risk with that word is that it's conflating a religion with a race. And so what we get to there is this idea that various forms of speech around what is often described as Muslimness, that's the phrase that the government often used, perceived Muslimness or Muslimness, will therefore be curtailed. So the risk that we've got is that we'll end up with an Islamophobia definition that this council, Dominic Grieve's led council, will affirm and approve, which is sort of saying, well, actually, there's various parts of Islam and Islamic practices and Islamic customs that you can't criticise, because it's not up for debate, because it's almost like an innate characteristic. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a racial characteristic, and therefore it's a form of discrimination. It's a form of racial incitement to hatred. We can't have these criticisms of Islam and Islamic practices. So, I mean, that's the headline. We could go back and talk about where this type of definition of Islamophobia comes from, but at the Free Speech Union, we're concerned that vast swathes of really, really important conversations that need to be had about Islam in a multicultural society will be chilled by this definition if it's imposed either a statutory definition, which would be kind of disastrous for free speech, but even a non-statutory definition, which is picked up by councils, by professional associations, political parties, and then is used as a kind of a code of conduct for employees or staff members. Can't talk about this. You can't talk about this either. And it will chill speech. That's our fear.
Mm-hmm. And am I right in thinking that it's heavily assumed that the kind of definition that they're talking about would reflect that all-party parliamentary group on British Muslims definition that's come up a few years ago? Is this cross-party effort chaired by Anna Subri in West Streeting, if memory serves? This idea that Islamophobia is a form of racism rooted in hostility to Muslimness, expressions of Muslimness, real and perceived, and so on. That's a definition I understand that the Labour Party have already into their own internal kind of processes have applied. So are you saying that the concern is less that there's going to be a clear-cut law that says XYZ isn't allowed to be said, but something which could in effect be used to punish members of staff in the government bureaucracy more broadly. Is that what you're getting at?
That's right, yeah. And just to come back to your original question, Dominic Grieve actually wrote the foreword mm-hmm. to the original all-party parliamentary group on British Muslims report on Islamophobia. And he has been somebody who kind of, while he recognises that it might have an effect on freedom of expression, he's been fairly pro the APPG definition. So our fear, of course, is that actually it's going to be that definition, but slightly repackaged. Mm-hmm. And in terms of will it chill speech, even if it's non-statutory, yes. And we know that there's various parties. So the Greens, for instance, the Lib Dems, Scottish Conservatives, not the English Conservatives, where the Scottish Conservative Party have adopted it. We know of at least 52 local councils that have adopted this definition. Trade unions have adopted this definition as well of Islamophobia. And it sort of cascades down into acceptable language in the workplace, codes of conduct for members, and so on. And at the Free Speech Union, we know of two very recent cases where local councillors have been subject to disciplinary proceedings because they posted things about mm-hmm. Islam. Now, when you hear that, you might think these are the most heinous, kind of egregious things that they've been saying about Islam and Muslims. No. I mean, one of the councillors was criticising the decision to award the World Cup to Qatar and talking mm-hmm. about Islamic customs and Islamic practices and sort of deep-seated misogyny in that culture. But that councillor adopted a pretty much cut-and-paste version of the APPG definition of Islamophobia, and therefore it became a disciplinary issue. And we had to step in and we went to bat for this councillor. But that's the risk. Mm-hmm. Writ large across the country, it will become a procedural issue that HR officers and compliance officers have looked for. And they'll be thinking, okay, well, this person's talking about Islam and it's not positive about Islam. This is clearly a code of conduct issue. Mm-hmm. That's really under the Labour government now. One of the risks is not actually direct legislation. It's these kind of almost like back channel attempts through non-statutory definitions, through working groups and steering groups. They're coming up with policies that don't actually make it into formal law, but have an impact on what professionals and employees and local councillors just don't want to talk about mm-hmm. because they know somewhere in their organisation there's going to be a definition that will be weaponised.
Absolutely. Chris, any thoughts on Dominic Grieve's Islamic blasphemy law? Pro, anti?
Well, don't get Dominic Grieve to do it for a start. I mean, of all the people you could choose, you might as well get Rory Stewart to do it. I mean, he's a guy who's got basically no skin in the game other than he wants to impress the left. He's bound to come up with an overly excessive definition of this. But, on the broader point, I'm going to say Islamophobia, however you define it, shouldn't be illegal, nor should prejudice against Christians or anybody else. I'm, quite happy to not have laws against homophobia or anti-Semitic speech. But I believe in free speech. That's the bottom line. I do understand, however, that, being Jewish or being gay, these are innate characteristics, and some people, perhaps with some justification, see that as a bit different mm-hmm. to your choice, I emphasize the word choice, of religion. And that's why this particular infringement on free speech is even worse than all the previous ones. Let's face it, there are extreme forms of Islam which are amongst the most serious threats to liberal democracy. And the idea that we might not be able to criticize them or point this out is bonkers and kind of suicidal. If you don't hate the Taliban, for example, after what they've been doing to women in Afghanistan, there's something wrong with you. And you should absolutely be allowed to say that you hate them. Same with ISIS. Same with a lot of, all jihadi groups and a lot of Islamic fundamentalists. That's not to say that Islam per se is evil or wrong, but there's a non-trivial mm-hmm. proportion mm-hmm. of people on the extreme ends of that that religion over the course of the last 40 years who are quite obviously a threat to Britain and to Western values and civilization. And we should be allowed to point mm-hmm. that out. And clearly there is, this is not paranoia to worry about there being a slippery slope with this stuff mm. because we've already seen the slippery slope so much already. We went from being hate crimes in which an actual crime had to be committed, but then had some prejudice put on top of it, to hate crimes are now just speech.
Yeah.
Right? You're committing a hate crime just by expressing an unpopular opinion. And of course, it's not that long ago. Was it last month? You had the guy burning the Quran, mm-hmm. who then got stabbed, and then the guy who got stabbed got arrested, as did, of course, the guy who did the stabbing. You know, and I don't think burning a Quran is necessarily the nicest thing to do. But being arrested for it is worse. And worse than either of those things is the fact that you can be stabbed for burning a Quran. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that is the real threat that we face as a society. Absolutely. And obviously we should be allowed to criticize it.
And just to come back actually to the sort of the threats that are there. So one of the most worrying things about the APPG definition of Islamophobia is in the report. One of the many shocking examples that the parliamentarians give of Islamophobia is they call it a sort of a stereotyping trope, a historical trope about Muslims being involved in grooming gangs. So the idea is that to even mention the idea that grooming gangs that groom young women, young teenagers, might have a disproportionate number of Muslims within them, that's Islamophobia, to even suggest that. But we know from the data, and this is not just kind of, you know, academic research data, it's data from the 43 police forces around England and Wales, that there is a disproportionate number of Muslims that have been arrested as part of grooming gangs around this country in northern towns like Rotherham and so on. But what we then find is that if you're saying, well, actually that's Islamophobia, to councillors, to local councillors, mm-hmm. or to journalists, they're going to back off. And even if they do dare to speak up about this and actually say, look, we've got a real problem here with a disproportionate number of Muslims involved in grooming gangs, then they're going to get into trouble for it. And we've seen various journalists who've reported on this. I mean, there's even Labour MPs in the past who've tried to sound the alarm about this issue, who've been shouted down or had to resign or faced all sorts of sort of internal pressure from their employers for raising that issue. It's an important issue. And if we can't talk about it, we've got a big problem.
No, absolutely. And that was another thing that was fascinating about when that extremism review that the government had launched in the wake of Southport, if I remember correctly, which finally reported back, or at least was about to report back, Policy Exchange got their hands on it. And it never properly saw the light of day because it was repeating a lot of the insane suggestions that you were articulating there, insofar as suggesting that to talk about, I think they refer to it as so-called group-based sexual exploitation, alleged cases of it, was potentially a kind of far-right trope. That it was, the Labour Party had to very quickly distance themselves from that. But it seems like they're sort of saying one thing and doing another. They're continuing to kind of push these definitions, these systems that will make it a lot harder to talk about, let alone actually tackle.
I think it's a real problem that we've got for the sort of chattering classes, the metropolitan elites. It's much more, it's easier, it almost feels good for them to be able to dismiss these problems as something that is just a far-right trope rather than having to engage with it, because they've invested so much in the political project of multiculturalism that it's much easier now for them to actually blame the far right. So, well, that's being caricatured. That's an exaggeration. That's just false. That's disinformation, rather than actually engaging with the issue. And when you look at the data, the issue's there. But what's scary is they don't want to see it. And to me, you know, the you're right that government ministers came out and disowned those aspects of the report. But the fact that you've got civil servants and so-called policy experts that think that way and can so casually dismiss decades of evidence that young white girls are being groomed by grooming gangs that are disproportionately Muslim, and just say that that's a so-called problem and talk about it as a far-right trope, I think that's really worrying, that they are the gap between reality and their sort of ideological perceptions is that wide that they don't even want to address it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And before we move on to some of the nanny state stories we're going to talk about today, also just very quickly on this topic, which has become almost a geopolitical touch point because of the battle between Keir Starmer and JD Vance, quite passive-aggressive exchange that we saw in the Oval Office, is this issue of the UK government trying to force Apple effectively to unwind some of their encryption as it relates to being able to investigate people for serious crime and so on. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that? Because I know you've written about it, and it's something that seemingly the Americans are increasingly upset about.
Yes, I think the US administration, Trump's administration, is just slowly getting to grips with some slight tweaks to legislation during the Biden years that are relevant to the UK that have really allowed a situation to develop where the UK is now able to sort of almost bully US tech companies into increasing their surveillance powers. So the issue, which I think is, you know, to the foremost of the minds of the US administration at the minute, is encryption. And end-to-end encryption is the kind of thing that you get on WhatsApp. Pretty much everybody uses it, WhatsApp. It's a great thing for privacy, for digital privacy, which from a free speech perspective, is the flip side of free expression and free speech, is to have that kind of privacy to develop your thoughts, to moan, to whinge, to say things that are offensive, but to do it in private mm-hmm. and know that you have that privacy. But what, I mean, to be fair, it's not just the Labour government. There's Western governments for years have hated the idea of encryption because it means they can't snoop on what people are doing. And in fairness to them, the issue, the way they frame it, is around child sexual abuse and terror offences. Now, okay, well, that's fair enough. But when you break encryption, as loads of experts have pointed out for years, you are also empowered. So if you give a backdoor into, that's what it's called, you know, in the sort of literature, you give a backdoor into encryption so that you can snoop on what people are saying. It won't just be the quote unquote good guys who are using that backdoor. It will be criminals. It will be authoritarian governments and so on and so forth who can use that. But what the UK government has essentially done under a piece of legislation known as the Investigatory Powers Act, which civil liberties groups have long called a snooper's charter, is they've demanded that Apple find a way to break encryption on its iCloud encrypted services. So they're not targeting people at the moment. They need a warrant for individuals, and there are pretty tight legislative processes around about targeting individuals. But it's a pre-attempt. It's a pre-stage before doing that, where they say, you're on notice. We want you to find a way to break encryption on your services so that later down the line, we can come to you for a warrant and then you can grant us access to that person's data. What's so worrying about that is once that encryption backdoor is created, it can be used and exploited by Russia, by China, by Iran, by authoritarian regimes all around the world. We might say, well, we've got lots of checks and balances before a warrant can be issued, but these countries don't. And that's the problem. Once encryption is no longer fully secure, these countries with large market share can come to Apple and other big US tech companies and say, listen, if you want access to our markets, then we know you've broken encryption and we want access to these people's data now, and we're going to leverage our market access to our population to be able to get that. So the UK is opening a door, really, for authoritarian regimes all around the world to snoop on their citizens.
Mm-hmm. And also criminals, presumably, to exploit those backdoors as well. I mean, that's one. Yeah. This debate is often presented as a trade-off between privacy on one hand and safety on the other, but it's clearly also a trade-off between safety in some respects. Because if you think about, there's a lot of concern about children's use of online tools and the internet, social media and so on. But it doesn't take a huge jump of the imagination to see how, for instance, the ability of some terrible person to break into a 13-year-old girl's encrypted messages and using that for, you know, blackmailing purposes and all sorts of horrendous things is clearly a problem. And yet it's something that they don't seem to recognise when they blunder into these kinds of things. Let's turn to a couple of the nanny state stories you picked up. Let's start with vaping. Mm. It's a recurring piece of misinformation, in effect, that vaping is, if not worse than smoking, then maybe as dangerous. And there's been another dodgy study to this effect. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about this one in the Mirror?
In scare quotes, yeah. We're now at the point, folks, where 85% of smokers in this country believe that vaping is worse for you than smoking or as bad for you as smoking. 85%. It just goes up every year. It's staggering. A huge failure of public health messaging, but also, it has to be said, mainly a failure of the media. And I get that, you know, the media are not going to report that smoking is much, much worse for you than vaping because it's not a news story, whereas some guy coming out saying vaping's terrible is. But I wish it just, you know, show a bit of responsibility. So the latest one, not even a study insofar as, you know, the thing hasn't been published, the research hasn't even been finished. It's a guy who seems to be quite hungry for attention at what used to be known as Manchester Poly, who is called, let's name him, shame him, Maxime Boyden. He's a sort of French-Canadian guy, and he's a sports scientist. I dare say a very good sports scientist, don't know, but he's not. He's never done any research into vaping or anything like this before. And for a couple of years now, he's been popping up in the media talking about this experiment that he was about to do or is doing and soon will have finished doing, in which he basically gets people on exercise bikes and he tests their lung function, sees how much they can kind of breathe in and out and so on, and does some sort of test of their blood vessels. And every now and again, he pops up and says something more and more dramatic for the media, which started off as being, you know, vaping might not be as healthy as we thought, to vaping's as bad as smoking, and now it's vaping is worse than smoking, based on almost nothing, certainly nothing that anybody can read, because he hasn't written a study or submitted it for peer review or anything like that. But what we do know about his research is it's completely ill-equipped to make any kind of claim like that. I mean, the lung capacity doesn't tell you anything about whether you're going to get lung cancer, obviously. It's almost certain that the vapors in his study, and I think there's only a few dozen people involved in it anyway. You know, there's a bunch of people basically who are smokers, a bunch of people who are vapors, and a bunch of people who don't do either. But the vapors, you can bet pound to a penny, are going to be ex-smokers. Mm-hmm. So they're not going to have as good lung function as somebody who's never vaped or smoked anyway. So that's an obvious flaw in it. But mostly he's not looking at toxicants or cancer risk or the effects of smoke on, you know, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, any number of things that are really bad for you in cigarettes. He's looking at a couple of indicators based on people who in effect are ex-smokers anyway, and saying, oh, well, they're quite similar between the smokers and the vapors, therefore smoking not is not just as bad, but somehow is even worse for you. It's utterly irresponsible rubbish. The Mirror picked this up the other day, but it went around the world. You know, it was reported in the New York Post. Vaping worse than smoking, and yeah, okay, we're on 85% now. Presumably next year we'll be getting up to 95%.
It's absolutely incredible. I mean, like the fact that this... I mean, how has this so taken root, Chris, do you think? Is it just because of the journalists who, it sounds like a great story
well,
to them, and they'll happily just repackage a press release? Is that part
of this particular journalist on Twitter, somebody found a tweet in which he'd contacted this guy, Maxime, mm-hmm. saying, I'm running a story about vaping. Can you DM me? Which presumably he very happily did DM him. And then later on, when a bunch of, you know, people from the reality-based community got in touch with him saying, like, what the hell are you doing with this study? His story, it's based on nothing. He said something along the lines of, oh, I was warned about the vaping community, lots of money at risk, I guess, you know, this kind of thing. One of the problems is that journalists, unless they're very specialized in this area, which none of them are, all they can really do is kind of relive the story of the cigarette, right? So they're very familiar with what happened with cigarettes, and the risks were downplayed and dismissed originally, and there was a kind of cover-up, especially in the USA. And A, they don't want to fall for that again.
Yeah.
They don't want to be one of those people who look back and go, oh, we can't believe we did the same thing again with e-cigarettes. But B, they just assume it's going to be the same kind of story, or they know that there's a frame of reference for their readers. And it's just a more interesting story, obviously, if vaping turns out to be incredibly bad for you than if it turns out to be this fantastic thing that's going to rid the world of cigarettes.
And if it's even worse, that would be like, that's the jackpot, absolutely. Isn't it?
Yeah, basically, yeah. That's how it works. Yeah.
What do you think about this, Freddie? The extent to which there's been a lot of panic in the mainstream press about misinformation in recent years, and yet there's certain forms of it that they seem quite attached to, seems like.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just listening to this. It sounds, sort of step away from the question you've actually asked me. But I mean, I was formerly an academic, and I was an academic up till about 2021. And I can hear echoes in the research study that you've just explained, where you kind of are under this pressure to go for impact as an academic now. Yeah. There's an integrity that used to be there in academic work, where you go for research first, you do a peer-reviewed study, that would be published as the foundational thing, maybe two or three things actually. And then you do the impact work. Mm-hmm. We're, not that we called it impact at the time, it was like public engagement. But there is now such a focus in higher education on getting media stories, getting in the press. And that is what you build your promotions on. I mean, I don't know anything about this guy in particular, but there's a general phenomenon there that what they are rewarding is you getting into the press, and then potential students see that you're in the press, and then the idea is that they then come to do your course and they pay you their £9,000 student tuition fees. So I hear echoes of that, and it's like the quality control can sometimes go because you're chasing this media attention rather than focusing on actually doing research with integrity.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And Chris, unless there's any more on vaping being as deadly as smoking, should we also talk about the alarming number of students who are apparently using their student loans to furnish their gambling debts. Is that true, do you think?
I don't think it is somehow, Tom. I mean, I think we spoke last week about things that are so obviously not true if you just give them a moment's thought, and yet they just appear in the media, everyone seems to nod along to it. So the story in the Times this week was that, I think the main headline was 20% of students are using their student loan to gamble. But if you dug into this survey, There was a load of extraordinary findings in it. Now, bearing in mind that students these days are kind of renowned for, they don't drink, they don't smoke, they don't do a great deal. Apparently, they're all gambling like crazy, spending the best part of £2,000 a year on average. So, what was it? 60% of students gamble, and they spend £1,833 a year on average, right? The average for across the UK is less than a third of that, right? It's a few hundred pounds if you're a gambler. These guys are spending the best part of £2,000. 21% of students are problem gamblers. Again, across the population, it's 0.3%. Mm-hmm. There's a new survey that the Gambling Commission used that we spoke about last year, which says it's 2.5%. Either way, it is massively higher, supposedly amongst students. But what I think's happened here is another example of the sampling bias problem that you get in surveys. And this happens all the time, actually. I did a survey this week for the first time in a very, very long time. And it was obviously basically about long COVID. Mm-hmm. I could tell because it was the same people. I was involved at one point with this zero prevalence study from Imperial College. I could see it was the same people. And I just thought, I'm a very public-spirited person, Thomas. Absolutely. I thought, I'll take this survey. But my God, it was boring because it was clearly, he didn't say this explicitly, but he was clearly looking for people who either had long COVID or had some sort of side effect from the vaccines. And I haven't had long COVID and I haven't had any side effect from the vaccines. And I started doing it and it had the little percentage thing at the bottom and it was moving up really slowly. And the questions were so boring and not relevant to me. And I nearly gave up doing it, but I was just thinking about this gambling survey thing anyway. And I also thought this research project needs to have at least one person who doesn't have any problems with the vaccine and didn't get long COVID, right? But clearly most people like me who didn't have anything interesting to report would just get bored halfway through and just give up, you know? Yeah. And so that's what happens with all sorts of online surveys. And gambling surveys are no exception by any means. So the problem with the Gambling Commission's new online survey, which used to be done face-to-face and found a very low prevalence of problem gambling, is now done online and finds a relatively high prevalence, is that it's explicitly badged as being a survey about gambling. And so people who gamble are much more likely to do it than somebody who doesn't gamble. Why would anyone do a survey about something that they don't know anything about and don't do and not interested in any way? And I think the same must apply with this this student survey. It has a massively disproportionate number of Asian people taking part in it for a start off. And the Chinese, as you probably know, are very, very keen on gambling, have a very, very high rate of problem gambling in China, despite gambling incidentally being banned. So you start looking at this stuff and you see that there's 4% of female students are going to a casino. Okay, that's just about plausible. But they're going an average of 61 times a year to a casino, right? The male students, 10% of them are going to the casino and they're going over 100 times a year. These people either are very unrepresentative or they're just making it up, right? 6% of these students supposedly go to the horse races or dog races, like to the course, on course betting. An average of 70 times a year.
I feel like
there's just no way, is it?
This cultural phenomenon would have been clocked before. Yeah, they're all exactly. These, like,
dog racing is
Russell Group students just showing up at, Romford Dogs or something. With,
exactly. 2.5% of students, so that's 73,000 students, are spending more than £200 a week on gambling. That's 10 grand a year. None of this makes sense, does it? But there's no skepticism about it when it's published by the Times. Just go, all these students are gambling. I wish they were. I wish they were doing something like that. I really don't think they are. If you look at other surveys, if you look at the national survey before the Gambling Commission ruined it, in fact, even the most recent Gambling Commission survey, they found literally one problem gambler amongst all the students that they surveyed. Mm-hmm. And they surveyed quite a few. It was thousands and thousands of people. This was only 2,000 people, this survey. The Gambling Commission one, I think, is well over 10,000. They found one student who was a problem gambler. But this one, 1 in 5. Just to bring some free speech into this, another thing about the Gambling Commission, you might recall that they created this ridiculous online survey which comes up with massive outlier results in which problem gambling is like 8 times more prevalent than we thought it was. And then it started telling people how they could report this information because they know deep down that this survey is bollocks, right? And so they've come up with these arbitrary weird rules, like in their advice to journalists, saying things like you can report that 2.5% of the population have a gambling problem, but you can't say, you can't do the very simple maths to work out how many people it is, right? So you can't say 1.3 million people have a gambling problem, even though you're saying exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And they will send you letters. You know, they've been sending letters to the anti-gambling groups. They sent letters to The Critic when I wrote about this. Even though I was just writing about this. Obviously, I don't really believe there's 1.3 million people with a gambling problem. But we got an email saying, please stop using this statistic. It's like, well, it's your statistic, isn't it, really? You know? And they've also got a whole load of woke stuff about, you know, you can't say fat person or obese person anymore. You have to say living with obesity. So you can't call someone a problem gambler. You have to say somebody who suffers from gambling disorder and this kind of stuff.
Rolls off the tongue.
But also, you can't even say that problem gambling is something that only affects a minority of people. I mean, even if you think it's 2.5%, that is a small minority of people. You say, no, you can't say that. You've got to say it's widespread. Well, hang on, this is just policing. This is just propaganda now, isn't it, right? Which is more truthful, saying it's a minority problem or it's widespread, clearly. Yeah. So they can't really regulate this. You know, they can't actually do anything, certainly to people like me or you. Mm-hmm. But the Gambling Commission has gone way, way off piste. You know?
Yeah, it's like a very early kind of early form of what could become a speech code of the kind that we see at the Free Speech Union all the time.
And that, absolutely
and
is,
that language, if you're not obese, you're living with obesity. We see that across NHS trusts all the time now. And it's like it's a speech code, but it's also embedding sort of ideological assumptions about personal responsibility and personal autonomy and individual risk for your own lifestyle.
Because it makes it seem like there's something you're suffering from and you've got no control over
it. Absolutely. It's just not your...
Passively.
Yeah, not your fault at all. It's just one of those circumstances.
Which is what they believe, of course.
Yeah, which is embedding an ideology and political assumptions into language. You see it all the time, all the time across public sector bodies now. That kind of what you might call almost like an old school conservative thing about you have to look after yourself and look after your own health and take responsibility is being slowly kind of squeezed out of the kind of language that professionals and experts can
use.
But
it's being dressed up as just being politeness, isn't it?
Always being kind.
But there's they've even finally started doing it with smoking now. Smokers were the last ones because obviously they hate smokers. Yeah. But it is now like people who smoke.
Yeah. That's so funny. Living with tar.
Living with alcoholism, this kind of stuff. It's clumsy apart from anything else. The other purpose it serves is, like a lot of stuff in the public sector in particular, is to create these kind of, it's status-driven, isn't it, in a way? Yeah. It's to weed out the people who didn't go to the right universities and do the right courses.
Yes.
And is not up to speed with what the latest phrase is, and that then...
The professional managerial class kind of managing themselves and their status distinction.
Like constantly changing
all the right
jargon.
Language. Exactly. Yeah. Who's going to get promoted and not? Yeah.
And the cost of clarity when dealing with healthcare officials, you know, that's the other thing. Like the idea that you're trying to kind of get something across to someone, get some information off them, work out what their health status is, and you're talking in enormous multi-hyphenate jargonized phrases to try and get there is absurd. But before I let you two go, should we reach into the postbag, Chris?
Oh, yeah.
Postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
Plenty in the postbag. Let's whittle it down to a couple. Question from John Bryan. It's a British politics
friend
question.
Friend of the show.
Who, and a big gambler as well, I should say. Pro-gambling guy. Who's your money on for the chop in Starmer's next reshuffle? So I guess we could split this up into, you can either do who you think's going to go, who you would like to go,
yeah,
or both. Any takers?
Well, I would like it to be either Bridget Phillipson or Ed Miliband, because I think they're the two really dangerous presences in the cabinet. I don't think Labour is particularly terrible overall compared to the previous Conservative government. It's very much like the Rishi Sunak government, really, except with a kind of vendetta against farmers and people who go to school and the net zero thing. I suspect that it might be Miliband. I mean, I can't discount some sort of sex scandal, which is probably quite likely, or somebody punching someone. But if it's just done on basis of politics, I think it would be a Miliband. He'll have to go at some point.
It certainly feels that way. What do you think, Freddie?
Well, I'll go for the free speech angle and say I would like it to be Bridget Phillipson. From our perspective at the Free Speech Union, we were totally, totally shocked by the fact that one of her first actions as Education Secretary was to pause commencement of the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Act, which was a piece of legislation that was designed to tackle cancel culture at English and Welsh universities. It had got cross-party support during the previous parliament. It was all good to go. And she paused commencement so that she could have a think about some ideas about, you know, it would likely lead to more hate speech on campus, and all sorts of other kind of safetyist cliches of that kind. We're currently pursuing a judicial review against that decision to pause commencement. She said that she'll bring the piece of legislation back, but we don't know when yet, and we don't know how watered down it's going to be. So I would like to see, her reshuffled, as it were.
Absolutely. I think we can all get behind that. Freddie, before I ask you the final question, which we ask all of our guests, because we are a very pro-freedom, anti-ban kind of podcast, we ask all of our guests, if you had to have one ban, what would it be?
You are a dictator. Ah.
We've actually got an entry here from a listener and another friend of the show, Alex Dale. Suggestion for a ban, if no one has already, the tethered bottle cap. I feel like, have we covered that on the show before?
I don't
certainly
think we have, actually, have we?
Because that's why I wanted to bring it up, because that was a great one, Alex. Thank you for that. But yes, hopefully that wasn't your pick, Freddie. But
no, it wasn't,
what if you had to have one ban, what would it be?
Well, do you know what? At the moment, the one that speaks most to me is I have to use a workspace quite a lot when I'm down in London. So, you know, kind of like Regus workspaces where there's lots of people all working on sort of tables in a big room. And it's supposed to be kind of this environment where you can work, and there's phone booths that people can go to. And what you find time after time is that people have these really ostentatiously loud phone calls and they just sit there, or they stand there, and everybody's trying to work, and they're having... And the other thing, the reason why I'd like to ban that is because they seem like specifically curated conversations. So it's always about things like, oh yeah, the takeover that's going on at the moment, you know, like we've got six mil on the, but what we need is to match fund. It's always like really impressive phone calls.
Bellies.
No. It's never anything like, you know, do you want to pick up toilet roll on the way home, darling? Yeah, so if it's not just that it disrupts you, it seems like it's also a little bit showy.
Yeah.
Showy off. So I would ban people from using phones in workspaces. That's mine.
I like it. I think it'll be a popular choice. Freddie, Chris, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.